In the relatively calm and confident years before the Holocaust, a number of our congregations were of a mood to dispense with Purim. They felt that it was anachronistic, a reminder of another and now blessedly past age. They felt that Purim, with its resonance of the oppression of Jews, the sense of the separate destiny of our people, the sense of its tragic destiny, this resonance was best put aside, forgotten. For they held that these were new times, different spirit, texture. And that Jews had better forget the shadows of the past, to learn to live in the larger world and to learn to live confidently in that world because it was a better world. The old prejudices, the old hates were presumably forgotten. The need to have a scapegoat, anti-Semitism and all that it represents was largely behind us, certainly in the more advanced nations. But all that Purim did, these congregations felt, was to keep alive for Jews the terror of life, anxiety, fear, trembling. And that this was a new world and these fears had best be forgotten. And there was a second concern of these congregations. And that was that the celebration of Purim was raucous, loud, all those awful noisemakers, those Gregors sounding out in the synagogue as Jews tried to drown out the name of Haman. They felt that this was an age when religion ought to deal with all gravity and all solemnity only with the saintly, the high, the exalted, the spiritual. And somehow the whole mood of feeling, of congregational enthusiasm did not fit that age. It was an age which liked to forget that the Hasidim threw their arms around each other's shoulders and danced away the shadows and danced their faith in God. It was an age of dignity, decorum, a brand new, reasonable, hopeful, encouraging world. I know of no other holiday or joyous occasion whose celebration indicates more dramatically than Purim just how far we have moved emotionally in the last 30 or 40 years. We no longer find Purim dissonant, anachronistic, something out of a medieval times, times which no longer exist. There have been other Hamans, Hitler, Stalin. There have been new Hamans, Gaddafi, Assad, Arafat, Brezhnev, Kosygin. We recognize again the wistfulness and the despair and the whimsy, if you will, of the old Jewish folk axiom that there are so many Hamans, and only one Purim. Our lives have turned full cycle. And though obviously we still hold on to some measure of hope, we know that we do not live in a radically new age, and that it is still part of life to live with fear, terror, terror of the unknown, of the uncertain and insecure, terror of the hate and the capacity to hate which poisons the human soul, terror at the capacity to be cruel, vicious, which lies, unfortunately, at the root of so much in human nature. I wondered this last week, just how the community in Israel was celebrating Purim. Since 1912 in Tel Aviv, there's been a procession through the streets, a great carnival time called Ad Lo Yada. Ad Lo Yada is a phrase taken from the Talmud, which means until you do not know. And the text in the Talmud says that on Purim, we ought to revel, to celebrate, Ad Lo Yada, until we do not know, we cannot recognize anymore the difference between the phrase Arur Haman, cursed be Haman, and Baruch Mardechai, blessed be Mordechai. In Tel Aviv, usually there's a great procession through the streets, glamorous floats depicting the Purim story, and I suppose many of the scenes of the saga of modern Israel. I have not yet read the reports of yesterday's Ad Lo Yada, but I'm sure that there was a kind of desperate joy to it. The very same kind of desperate joy with which Purim has been celebrated by Jews, lo, these last 2,000 years. Purim has come back to us, which is to say that the world has turned back from its promise, what men believed to be its promise of 80, 90 years ago. Now, we make no claim, none of us, that Purim represents the highest reach of the Jewish spirit. It's carnival time. It speaks of despair and it speaks of relief. It speaks of a kind of joy which we ought to engage in, which we inevitably engage in when suddenly the dangers are over. That sigh of relief, that hope that maybe now, things will be better. Purim is simply part of life, even as terror is part of life, cruelty is part of life, and the occasional moments of deliverance are also part of life. Whoever wrote the Megillat Esther, the Megillah, the story of Purim, I think would be very shocked to realize that for the last 1800 years, we have bound the book in white buckram, as it were, in the sense of holiness which pervades all of the anthology we call the Bible. And we've given it to our daughters to carry at their marriage. We've given it to our children at their confirmation. For the book was certainly never written, or the story was never told, for it's obviously a great Oriental folk story, as a holy book, as a holy story. In fact, one of the strange elements in the Book of Esther is that the name of God is never mentioned. Even though there are a number of portions in which it would be quite natural for the author to have spoken the word God. For instance, when he says, and salvation will come to the Jews, he never mentions the word God, as if deliberately wanting to keep this a secular text, a text which speaks of terror and relief in the way that ordinary people know it and experience it, as if he really didn't want it to seem holy, to have to reach towards a degree of sanctity which the rest of the Bible tends to try and to achieve. Yet we have declared the book to be biblical. We have canonized it. And the reason it was canonized in the second century of this era, the last of the books of the Bible to be accepted into the canon, has to do more with the history of the previous century than with the intention of the teller of this tale. For until modern times, the cruelest century in Jewish life was a century which runs from about 50 of the Common Era to the next 100 years. In 66, crushed by the iron boot of Rome, brutalized by Roman exactions and taxes and the misrule of the procurators, our people rose in rebellion. And by the year 70, the city of Jerusalem had been destroyed, the temple had been razed, the central sanctuary of Jewish life was no more. 1 million Jews were killed in that rebellion. And about 40 years later, the year 112 of the Common Era, many of the Jewish communities in the diaspora, in Cyrenaica, in Crete, in Egypt, and elsewhere, rose in rebellion against Rome, and they were brutally crushed. And another 1 million of our people seemed to have been slaughtered or sold into slavery. And just 20 years later, led by Bar Kokhba, the Jews of Palestine rose again in rebellion, and in time they were crushed, 135 of the Common Era. And again, 1 million or more were killed or enslaved. This was a century of terrible tragedy and an unparalleled defeat. And a Jewish community which had been growing and had been finding a new sense of its political stature up to this time. Before the first century, we Jews represented perhaps 20% of the population of the Eastern Roman Empire. We were a strong and increasingly significant minority whose views, whose philosophy, whose faith was increasingly noticed. Now suddenly we were a defeated people, a forgotten people, and we turned to licking our wounds and to finding a way to survive. Well, certainly during such a century, the message of the Book of Esther, which is simply the message that salvation will arise for our people. Do you remember the central speech of the book? The evil decree has gone out. Haman has gotten to Ahasuerus, the Persian emperor, and he has convinced Ahasuerus that he is to have all of the Jews turned over to him and they are to be slaughtered on the 14th day of Adar next. And Esther is the queen, and Mordecai sends a message to her that the fate of her people is in her hands. And the message is phrased in these three stark, simple sentences. Do not believe that you will escape in the king's house if you are silent now. Relief and deliverance surely will come for the Jews from some source. Who knows whether you did not come to royal estate for this purpose? Surely relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from some source. Despite it all, relief and deliverance will come. Certainly that was a healing message. And more than this, there was a moral here for those Jews who over the centuries or in that century would have some position of authority, some opening, some way of contacting the princes, the emperors, the dukes, the Caesars. There were always Jews who had at times the ear of power. And now that the armies of Israel had not been able to protect the people of Israel, now it was up to those who had this access to use it, even at personal cost, to try and undo the evil decree, a harsh fate, whatever the situation may be. Obviously, the book of Esther was included in the Bible because it was both a promise and it imposed a new morality upon those Jews who were thrown up into positions of wealth or power that they must respect and be concerned with the fate of Israel. But even as they canonized the Bible, the rabbis and those who translated the scripture into Aramaic, into Greek, into Latin, recognized that there were problems within the text. That it was a good text, it was in a sense true to life, there were many dangers and many needs for deliverance. But they used to interpret this book in a way to remove from it some of the questions, some of the moral problems, if you were, that it poses. In the first instance, the absence of the name of God. But more importantly than this, The fact that though Esther is a beautiful woman, a royal princess, and in time she becomes a heroine, it's quite clear that she's not the most apt model for a Jewish girl to pattern herself after. For obviously, until the time when she reveals herself as a Jewess to the king, he's not aware of her faith, of her religious loyalty. Now, how could the queen of all the Persians have remained anonymous, a Morano, if you will, if she had not failed to observe the Sabbath, if she had not failed to observe the holidays, if she had not failed to observe kashrut, the dietary laws? Obviously, as one who had dissembled about her Jewishness, she had simply not carried out the practices of the Jewish people. And more than this, or in the eyes of the moralist, worse than this, since Jewish life believes implicitly in modesty, decency, and morality, Esther was hardly in this respect the model for a very lovely young Jewish lady. For what had she done? She'd entered a beauty contest in order to become a concubine of the king. And instead of spending her time spinning and weaving and doing homely things, she had spent 6 months anointing herself and being massaged and perfumed and her hair being coiffed and doing all those things that starlets do in order to make themselves into sex symbols. And somehow a Jewish girl was not to make herself into a sex object. And she had obviously gone into the king as a member of his harem without marriage. Again, hardly the very model of what a Jewish father wanted his Jewish daughter to be. Early in the second century before the Common Era, before the Book of Esther was canonized, a Jew from Alexandria named Demetrius took a translation of the Book of Esther with him from Jerusalem, a translation which had been done by a certain man whom we know as Lysimachus. Now, we don't know much about Lysimachus, except we know that instead of providing a Greek translation simply of the Book of Esther, he had drawn out the book and added to it things that he felt were of moral uplift, which made it fit for family consumption. And these editions, if you ever want to read to them, are available now in English. We've translated them. They're part of the Apocrypha, part of the other books of the Bible which were not canonized. They're called the Additions to Esther. Lysimachus published this text around 116 before the Common Era. And he turned Esther from a concubine, a sex object, a non-observant Jewess, into the very, very model of a proper Jewish maiden. How did he do it? Very simply. He tells the story exactly as the way the story is told in the familiar scroll. And then just before Esther is to enter to the audience chamber to make her plea to Ahasuerus to free the Jews from this terrible edict, he has her utter a prayer to God. And the prayer sets everything straight. Let me read a part of it to you. Then Queen Esther, caught up in this deadly conflict, took refuge in the Lord. She stripped off her splendid attire and put on the garb of mourning and distress. Instead of proud perfume, she strewed ashes and dung over her head. She abased her body in every part that she had delightfully adorned, she covered with her disheveled hair. And so she prayed to the Lord God of Israel. O my Lord, thou alone art our king. Help me who am alone, with no helper but thee. Save us by thy power and help me who am alone, who have no helper but thee, O Lord. O Lord, thou knowest all. Thou knowest that I hate the splendor of the heathen, that I abhor the bed of the emperor who is uncircumcised. Thou knowest in what straits I am, that I loathe that symbol of pride, the headdress, the crown that I wear when I show myself abroad. I, thy servant, have not eaten at Haman's table, I have not graced a banquet of the king or touched the wine of his drink offerings. I've kept the dietary laws. I have not known festive joy from the time that I was brought here until now, except in thee, O Lord God of Abraham. In other words, by a private public confession, Lysimachus manages to undo all the suspicions about Esther that many had already found in her actions. And Lysimachus continues because he's faced with a problem in Mordecai. Mordecai is a great hero. Mordecai is loyal to the emperor, and you'll recall that Mordecai reveals to the emperor Ahasuerus a plot against his life. He comes across in the story of Esther as the man who hears of Haman's acts against the Jews and warns Esther to enter into the audience chamber and plead for her people's life. He's a hero. But there's only one trouble, or two, or three, if you want Mordecai to be a very model of a Jewish gentleman. The first is that it's under his guidance that his niece and ward, Esther, enters the harem of Ahasuerus. Now, what fine uncle will allow his ward to become a member of the harem of a movie producer, or to enter that kind of jet set life? More than this, it is his action which endangers the life of all Jews. He had, as you recall, refused to bow down to Haman. Now, the suspicion is there that he did this for no better reason than that he was vain. He didn't like Haman, and he wasn't about to bow down to him. And because of his vanity, the vanity of one courtier to another courtier, he endangers the life of a whole people. Why had he refused to bow down? The Book of Esther doesn't indicate a reason, but perhaps it codes the reason. About the only reason which we can derive from the Book of Esther for this act, which had such dramatic consequence, is the fact that Haman is called an Agagite, Haman ha'Agagi. Now, according to the Bible, Agag was the king of Amalek, one of those small Bedouin communities that lived in the second millennium before the Common Era on the east bank of the Jordan River. And the Bible tells us that when the children of Israel left Egypt, they asked the right of peaceful passage through the land of Edom, the land of Moab, the land of Amalek, and that the Amalekites had granted to them the right of peaceful passage. But as they'd gone through, took a matter of a few days, I suppose, the Amalekites had suddenly ambushed the community of Israel. They attacked first the rear guard and then the whole camp. And there'd been a terrible slaughter. And there is in the book of Deuteronomy a warning which begins, Zachor et Amalek. Remember Amalek. When you crossed the wilderness, Amalek attacked you in a dastardly way from behind in ambush. His word had been given, and he was not true to his word. Blot out the memory of Amalek from before me. And this phrase, Zachor et Amalek, has become a watchword term in Jewish life for beware of the enemy, beware of the sudden danger. Haman also presented a sudden, unexpected danger, as had Amalek before him. And presumably because Mordecai recognized in Haman a descendant of these hated people whom Jews are to be aware of and beware of constantly, he refused to bow down to him. That's possible. No other reason exists in the biblical text. And so the suspicion obviously arose early that Mordecai had acted simply out of vanity. In order to protect the good name of Mordecai, Lysimachus writes another prayer. Just as Esther had voiced a prayer before she had gone in to see the king, so Mordecai voices a prayer just before he reveals to Esther what she must do, asking God's help. And it's phrased in these terms. O Lord, King, thou who rulest over all, the whole world is under thy authority, and when it is thy will to save Israel, there is none who can stand against thee. O Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest, O Lord, that it was not from insolence or arrogance or vainglory that I refused to bow before proud Haman, for I could gladly have kissed the soles of his feet to save Israel. No, I did it so that I might not hold a man in greater honor than God. I will not bow before any but thee, my Lord, and it is not from arrogance that I refuse this homage. In other words, an explanation of his act is put into this confession. He had refused to bow down to Haman because Israel must bow down only to the one God. Now, there's only one trouble with this confession, this explanation. We know absolutely no custom in ancient times which precluded a Jew from bowing to one who was an overlord. What we do know is that among the Greeks, the free Greeks, the custom has grown that a Greek must not bow down before any man. And apparently during the Greek age, the Hellenistic age, this custom became widespread. It was a sign of one's dignity not to bow to any other man. The Jews took it over from the Greeks. And here in Greek times, Lysimachus is giving an explanation to Hellenistic Jews, Jews who have become Greek in many of their attitudes, for the reason that Mordecai did not bow to Haman. The need to interpret Esther, to fumigate it, to make it fit for religious consumption, has existed from that day to this. I've cited to you the oldest of the Midrashim, the oldest of the set of editions. There were many others. Josephus tells another story. The Midrash tells another story. The Aramaic, so-called Aramaic translation, the Targum, recast the story in a slightly different way. All of which suggests that from the very beginning, our people were quite aware that the Book of Esther does not represent morality, the standard of rectitude and righteousness and saintliness which is incumbent upon every Jew, but it represents rather history, reality, tension and release. And the story, in fact, is phrased in these quite human terms. It's phrased in terms of the human comedy and the human tragedy, in terms of farce and occasional nobility, in terms of tragedy, unexpected tragedy, undeserved tragedy, and relief, joy, unexpected relief, and deliverance. Let me try briefly to suggest to you these four themes, how they exist in this story. First, the farce. The very opening of the book is farce. There's a great, great celebration in Susa, the capital of Persia. It's lasted for 180 days and 180 nights. The emperor has had all the notables of Persia from the many, many provinces from the west all the way to India at his royal banquet table. There's gold dishes and silver dishes and lapis lazuli goblets, the most splendiferous kind of display. And after 180 days and 180 nights, you would think that the party had worn a little bit thin. But no, the Persians had not had enough, and they proclaim another festival to last for 7 days and for 7 nights. Their appetites are being jaded. And at this point, in order to encourage jollity, the king decides to summon his queen, Vashti. And he orders Vashti to appear before his nobles that they may enjoy her beauty. And Vashti, who, by the way, in my mind, is one of the great unsung heroines of woman's liberation. Vashti, without reason, simply says, "No, I'm not coming. I'm not your sex object. the centerfold of Playboy magazine. I won't appear that way before your nobles. And she refuses. And then the farce really begins. This mighty emperor of almost all the known world, sitting there in his cups with all the great nobles and powerful men of the kingdom before him, doesn't know what to do about a single woman who says no. So he summons a great council of state, the seven wisest counselors in all of Persia. And this great emperor, whose word is law, whose word can kill a man, says plaintively, "What should I do? What should I do?" And Memucan, I can see him now standing there, his hands clasped like this, rocking back and feet in the immemorial way of counselors, listens to the king's plight, pulls a little bit of his beard, wonders what he can answer the king that the king wants to hear. Memucan thinks and paces the floor, and he says finally, "My lord, you must put away Vashti, the queen." But he can't do it, say it simply that way. You must put her away. You must put her away because in doing so, you're doing a service for all of Persia. It can't be simply your own anger at her, your bitterness, your frustration. For my lord, if you do not put her away, every woman in Persia is going to learn to say no to her husband. And what will the world come to? "Aha," says the king. "My anger at Vashti is now justified. There's a purpose to it all." And so he orders a letter to be written. It's one of the most pompous, amazing letters of all times, to be sent out to all the 120 provinces of Persia, from Syria to India, from Turkey to the Sudan, which says in effect that every man is to be master in his own house. By order of the Persian emperor. So be it. And I presume because of that letter, every man in Persia became the master in his own house. But in any case, what we have here is the authoritarian family, pettiness, a woman who will not have her dignity trampled on, and the kind of satire which is delightful, that here, the center of all power, frustration exists, stupidity exists, folly exists. And that's farce. And what about the occasional moments of nobility? We often forget that Esther and Mordecai were really not very nice people. But what were they really? Mordecai was a conniving courtier, and Esther was really little more than his willing pawn. Mordecai is not a hero figure. He's a man who was attracted to power and who wanted his bit of it. And so he comes around the court, and he's around where there's largesse and power, and he's looking for his opportunity. And he seems to find it when he overhears conversation about a plot against the king's life, and he reveals it to the proper authorities. But he's frustrated, because though the matter is written down in the royal record, there's no immediate reward for him. And then fortunately, this disposing of Vashti gives him a chance. He'll use his niece, a youngster, a girl, in order to further his advantage. And she's willing to be used. She's eager enough for what? A vial of perfume, some servants, some music, the quote good things of life to go along with this game. She goes to the harem. She enters the contest. Unfortunately for the story, she wins. But, you know, why was she there? They're not very nice, but they're shrewd, they're ambitious, they're selfish, they're self-indulgent. Call them what you will. And that's the way I suspect many people start out. But the test of people comes ultimately when the moment of truth is there. When the moment is there, when Mordecai and Esther have a chance to escape a fate which might be imposed on all others but them, or at least on all others but Esther, they're willing to stand up and to be counted. They're willing to gamble everything that they've won for a larger cause than their own selfish advancement. And that's a mark of nobility. It's not the greatest nobility in the world, but it's a true mark of nobility. And then the tragedy, and the very nature of tragedy. Haman, for trivial reasons, decides that all the Jews must be killed. His reason is no more than the fact that his nose is out of joint, that a Jew has refused to bow down to him. And what does he do? He gets from this foolish king the right to kill all of the Jews on the promise to hand over to the king a rather royal sum of money which the king needs for his own indulgence. Now, very often in life, the tragic hinges on a very minor kind of event. Somebody doesn't like us in the office. We don't get along well with certain kinds of people. We speak our mind at a time when someone else finds it appropriate. We bear a label, Jew, someone reacts prejudicially to. That's true in life. The tragic often enters our lives, not for reasons which we can control or even understand, but because there are people out there who simply react in ways which are unpredictable. Anti-Semitism has a long and bitter history in Europe. But who could have predicted, you know, on the basis of that history, that in the frustration and the fulminations of a wallpaper hanger in a German jail, there would come this bitter hatred of the Jew, which would lead to the Holocaust. Tragedy comes to peoples, to individuals, for strange and unexpected reasons. And the same is true of relief. It's interesting the way in which the book of Esther tells of the final release of the Jews from this terrible danger. No one may enter the royal audience chamber unless he is called. Esther has not been called. She takes her life into her hands. She enters the chamber, and the king graciously receives her. And instead of asking directly for the blessing then and there for what she wants, she invites the king and his prime minister, Haman, to a banquet. She offers them that night a lovely banquet. And at that banquet, again, she does not reveal what she has in mind, but invites them back a second time. And that second night, when she has again placed all of the delicacies of Persia before the emperor and his prime minister, she finally makes her plea. I am a Hebrew. I share the fate of my people. How can you have allowed this man to have our lives in his hand? And the king, this foolish king, what does he do? He doesn't say to Esther, I take it all back. He doesn't say to Haman, what did you do and how could you do it? Or, I agree with you, I will stay with what I said to you. According to the Bible, he runs out into the garden. He wants to avoid the whole problem. Haman is worried, though. He doesn't know quite what the king will do when he comes back. And he falls down and almost kneels before Esther, asking her to forgive him. And as he kneels, he throws himself across the bed, the chaise longue, the sofa of this room, And when the king comes back in, he sees Haman across the bed of his wife. And instead of being worried about these hundreds of thousands of Jews of the kingdom, what is he worried about? The fact that Haman may have made some advance to Esther. That's the only thing that concerns him. And it's because of that concern that he turns angrily at Haman and orders him out and to be hung. So the Jews were saved in ancient Persia because a foolish king foolishly thought that his prime minister was making advances to his wife almost in his own presence. Again, salvation, advancement, release, deliverance often comes to us from unexpected places and in unexpected ways. There's an element of fate. There's an element of mazel, or low mazel, no mazel to life. And that's also part of the story of Esther. The book of Esther, then, is history, it's life, it's release, it's a masquerade. This is one of the ways, by the way, in which we deny reality. We dress up as if we were someone else to deny the reality of those events. This afternoon in the Temple Branch, there'll be hundreds of youngsters dressed up as Esther or Mordecai, and a few brave souls will dress up as Haman, and if you would like to be president, we'll dress up as Ahasuerus, the emperor. And there'll be a howling success at the carnival this afternoon. It's carnival time. As we try and masquerade, deny by putting on masks, that there was a cruel reality to the story itself. And that, I suspect, is true also. One of the best and most effective ways that you and I have of dealing with this world as it really is simply not to look at it as it really is. That's why we dress up. That's why we complain about the black headlines. Give us some good news. That's why we forget as quickly as we can about the pain of illness and the anguish of the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s and early 1960s. We look at the sun of a bright March day, forget the grayness of the day before. We invent a rather romantic masquerade, which we call life. And somehow we allow that masquerade, that image, that illusion to carry us along. And if the book of Esther has any meaning, it says that it works sometimes. But there are times when we change miyagon l'simcha me'evel l'yom tov, from sorrow to gladness and from mourning to a celebration. Now, it's very hard to end a sermon which has to do with the ways in which we cope rather than which the values which we should achieve. And that's the problem, really, with any speechifying about Purim. Because it doesn't tell us, you know, the level of grandeur and nobility which we should attain. It simply says something about the terror of life, our need for relief and release, and for catharsis, for a masquerade. So how should we end it? I suppose the only ending that we can have is simply this. The Jews have been reading from the Megillah for 2,000 years. And what we do is we do not simply read the text. We chant it. We try to turn history into a song. And I suspect that that image, that symbol, is an appropriate one for all of us. If we can take life with all its pedestrian elements, all its danger, all the literal, cruel facts which surround our daily lives, and somehow turn our lives into a song of hope, a song of care, a song of professional accomplishment, then truly we will have won through. The jungle will have given way to civilization. The terror will have given way to beauty. Fear will have given way to possibility. So let's sing this poem away. Let's sing away the shadows. Amen.